Good morning. I'm Dan McCoskill with the Honolulu Advertiser, and we're at the Bishop Museum with Blair Collis, Vice President of Public Operations.
Hi.
Good morning, Blair. Thank you for speaking with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Tell me about Collis. Is that an unusual name? Or?
It is unusual. I get a lot of Collins as sometimes written or reported on, but it is a distinct name. It is it's from England, but it's derived from Ireland, and so it's a little rarer. But there are Collises even here other than myself in Hawaii. So,
who come from England, or their families come?
Mostly from England, you know, the British Isles, sort of, England was the funnel for going out everywhere.
Sure.
So there's Collises in America and in Australia.
And you're from Australia.
Yeah, I'm originally from Australia. I grew up there, born and raised, and I came over here originally on tennis scholarship to the University of Hawaii.
Tennis?
Yeah. And I just decided to stay. It was a place where I found I loved the people, loved the climate, loved the culture, and thought it was just a fantastic place to be. So I decided to make my home here.
And how old are you?
I'm 34 now.
And your title is Vice President of Public Operations.
Yep.
And you've had that job long time.
Not really. I it's been switched around. We've had some switcheroos lately. I started here as the press director. Actually, this is my second time around at the museum. I was under the previous director, Donald Duckworth, mm-hmm. for about a year.
And I did what?
As basically as a grant writer and corporate development. So a development officer here.
Uh-huh.
And
fundraising.
Fundraising. And I actually, one of the projects we were working on during the time I was here was a book on the historic images of Hawaii with a company called Mutual Publishing. And it was sort of a collaborative agreement between the museum, and I went over there with my supervisor and met the owner, and on the way over my boss said, well, he's looking for someone to hire, so you better watch out. And I didn't really think about it at the time because I hadn't really thought about book publishing as a career path. But indeed, he did offer me a job after meeting me a couple of times. And I took a chance and decided to go into book publishing. And then I guess I hadn't burnt my bridges here because the new director came on and wanted to start up the press again.
Right.
Instead of being inactive, the Bishop Museum Press.
Right.
And
you sort of get credit for rejuvenating that, right?
We, you know, the museum is a great place, you know, and so it was, you know, I'd like to claim credit, but there's a lot of great people here, and there's just a lot of great stuff to do books on. You know,
right.
I think that's all, you know, I just needed to be a catalyst to get it going. And it continued on its scholarly publications very strongly, and always has. It's the oldest book publishing house in Hawaii and one of the oldest scholarly publishing houses in the Western Hemisphere.
Really?
But it had fallen inactive, and for most part, most people in Hawaii didn't know, you know, its pedigree. It's done some of the most incredible books in Hawaiian cultural literature ever. Everything from Alelo Nui Ao by Mary Pakui to the Kamakau books and David Marlowe's Emerson translation of David Marlowe's Hawaiian Antiquities. Some of the really seminal publications in Hawaii. And so it had fallen inactive, and they'd really just had a part-time order taker and filler for the press for about 6 years before that. They were still publishing, but they're only doing about one book every year and a half to 2 years. So I got in here, and I had a staff of one person, and we just sorted everything out. With such a great institution and so many resources.
What year is that you came back?
2003. Uh-huh. So only about three and a half years ago, 4 years ago. So
let me back up a couple steps. So when did you start under Don Duckworth as a grant writer?
Oh, that would have been probably 1999 to 2000. I was here about a year.
Uh-huh. Okay, sorry. So
yep.
Then you came back in 2003.
So yeah, we came back and we had to sort out, you know, the operations, as there's no one really running the operation for you know, almost over half a decade. We, you know, the records needed to be updated, and warehousing and distribution agreements needed to be sorted out. Our product line needed to be developed. But again, with such many resources here, we're able to jump straight in. We had books that we wanted to reprint that mm-hmm. we were able to get going. We had books that we'd agreed to that before I'd come on, so I just needed to move them forward. And so while I was doing that...
To publish.
Yep. And while I was working our way through the things that we had already sort of committed to, we were working on things that we wanted to establish. And mm-hmm. so we didn't have a children's book line. We'd never done children's books. So I established a children's book line, and we do about 5 children's books a year now, and growing. We wanted to do Hawaiian language publications, which we'd continue to do. So we just expanded upon that. We're the largest publisher of Hawaiian language books in the world now, which is a good thing considering the press has only got, now still only has 2 full-timers and 1 part-timer.
How many titles existed before you came, and how many new titles have been added?
Well, we've been around, you know, the press has been around about 113 years.
Uh-huh.
So we've done about over 1,300 publications during that time.
And 1,300.
Most of them scholarly.
Yeah.
So most people wouldn't be able to pick them up at a bookstore. When I'd come on, we'd only done about a book every year to year and a half. And first year we did about 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did...
8 new titles.
8 new titles. Yep. Then we did... And some reprints.
Uh-huh.
And then the next year we did about 14 new titles and probably another 8 reprints. So we're up to about 22 titles, and now we hover around 25 to 30 publications, most of them new. Mm-hmm. And these are considered trade publications, so the kind of things you see in Borders and Barnes & Noble and all the bookstores, including Shop Pacifica, our own bookstore. And they range, we're now getting into a really good groove because we're getting into books and topics that have a really broad appeal, mm-hmm. like a book on Lua, the Hawaiian martial art of Lua.
I've seen that poster many places.
Yeah, and it's doing fantastic. It's one of those books where we're one of the natural people's organizations who could do a topic like this with our ties to Alohe, the teachers of Lua, and of course our collections. So we're receiving reorders from Barnes & Noble and Borders on the mainland, so it's getting national distribution now. So we're expanding, you know, it's exciting because we're expanding Hawaiian culture beyond Hawaii
mm-hmm.
in a tangible way and relating it to people's interests and universal things, you know, not just here but everywhere. So
is it a money-making operation? Finances have long been...
Yeah, it's turned around. You know, one of the things about museum and non-profit publishing houses, it's typically a loss. You know, it serves the purpose to primarily and for the most part sourcing mission. You know, you're
right.
Educating people, and that's why you have a publishing house. But Bill Brown, who came on as the director at the time, recognized the fact that this is not only an opportunity to disseminate knowledge and educate and fulfill our mission in that sense, but also be a revenue generating center. And so it is making money, and it's one of the few museum publishing operations in the country that make money. We don't do a survey of everyone because it's hard to say where you stop as far as a museum.
Right.
There's art museums, and they're not exactly in our game. But as far as natural history museums, we're one of the few operations that make money, and we do trade books as well as scholarly. And the concept is that we make these trade books and disseminate information on a broad-based consumer level that supports our mission, but also the scholarly
right.
publications as well.
So it's been a profit-making venture each of the last 3 years?
Yeah,
wow.
It started off straight away. You know,
great.
it wasn't hard. Well, because the thing is, we've got some great books, but part of the problem was distribution too. You know, and sourcing. You know, you attack the revenue side by creating better looking books and better priced books and better distribution, but you also attack the cost side by sourcing globally.
Mm-hmm.
How you produce those books. A lot of our books were made in the United States and the printing part aspect of it, and that's obviously, as you could expect, an expensive prospect
right.
for a publisher. So we source everywhere from Australia to throughout Asia and take advantage of that. And that's what every publisher does in Hawaii Book Publishers, so it's not unusual. Mm-hmm. And that way we can bring down prices. And that even itself is in line with our mission, because we've been able to take book prices of well-established books and bring the prices down. We brought down Native Planters of Old Hawaii. It was a $50 retail book. We brought it down to $34, $15 drop for, no reason other than the fact that we're sourcing better, and therefore mm-hmm. we can pass those savings on to the consumer.
Wow. So where were you, let's get to know you a little bit better. Where were you born in Australia?
I was born in Crown Street to Hospital Sydney.
Crown Street?
Crown. It was a famous hospital in Australia. It's no longer in existence, but
Crown like the...
Crown, yep, like the what you wear on your head if you're king or queen. And then we moved up the coast from there, and we moved into a variety of towns and places with my father's work. He basically ran clubs, and there's not a really comparable thing here, but they're called bowling clubs. They're lawn bowls, and they're sort of like casinos. They've got restaurants in them, and they have lawn bowls as a sort of a central activity.
But no
there's
kidding.
Gambling, and there's
like a social club?
Yeah, social club would probably be a good translation for it. And so he took jobs and promotions to up the coast of northern New South Wales, and we moved with that. And we moved to towns that are big and small. I've lived in...
Are these like country clubs?
Kind of. They don't. Country club, in my mind, sort of suggests there's a golfing aspect to it.
Yeah.
They don't. They didn't
and
they have
certain economics.
Super facilities. They didn't have large facilities. It was just more on the social club. And they couldn't get large. I mean, they're thousands of members and tournament play for lawn bowls. But I've lived in places that are a couple hundred thousand people. One of the towns I lived in was 300 people. It was a fishing village.
They had
a bowling club, we took he took the job because it was a great great benefits, but also a nice place to live. And they gave some benefits like a free house to live in, all these kind of things. But basically, it was 300 fishermen with their family, families, no police, no doctor, 50 miles from anything.
Wow.
And there was just the river mouth where they would go out, and then the beach and the lawn bowls club. So everyone would sort of congregate there, and he ran it. So
wow. And so were you destined for a life in lawn bowl club management?
No. But in an ironic way, I learned my tennis there. I got hooked on tennis because the one only other thing you could do was play tennis, because there was one tennis court. So my older brother and I, who's 3 years older than me, we'd soon enough get bored of the beach or anything else, and we'd play tennis. And so he would drive me insane because he would always beat me.
And brother.
My older brother, yeah. And he was bigger and obviously stronger and faster than me, and he would always beat me, and it just drove me nuts. And so I kept at it, and that's how I got into tennis and eventually came here on tennis scholarship because of it.
Okay, let's get to that in a second. So when did you finally beat your brother?
I never did before I left, because we never played. And but then the first year I came back, we...
So he's pretty good then.
No, actually, we just left it alone. He kind of realized that we moved out of that town and into sort of the closest city, and I started getting coaching lessons and playing and winning tournaments, and I sort of brought it up a couple of times, and he said, "Yeah, no, I don't have time to play." He was pretty cagey. He realized that it was
rest on his early victories.
Yeah. So.
Where did you go to high school? Where did you graduate from high school? Sounds like you.
I went to a place called Tormina, Toormina, Tormina High School.
Toormina.
Yeah, Tormina High School.
Where is that?
It's a really small little place called Sawtelle, which is right, almost like a suburb. S-A-W-T-E-L-L.
S-A-W-T-E-L-L.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's
a suburb. I'm sorry. Suburb.
It's almost like a suburb of another town where we lived, which was called Coffs Harbour. And it was a coastal town known for sailing and fishing again. But... Yeah, it was a pretty great school, actually.
What year did you graduate?
1989. I was young. I was 16, turning 17 when
wow.
I graduated. I just moved quickly through school, and I was lucky.
Did you like it, or you were bored, or?
I guess I was bored. A little bit of both. I liked it, and I was bored. But I moved through early, and but it was a cool little school because, I mean, it was sort of before its time. It had a surfboard as its logo. You know, it was kind of a real. Mm-hmm. Natural, a la natural kind of high school, but the education was good.
And then you were recruited to UH on a scholarship?
Yep. Yeah, I called up. I'd actually applied for a whole bunch of schools, and I got a couple of offers. I got one from UH, and I decided just one day that I had no idea about the semester system here. I picked up the phone in August, and I didn't know, you know, anything. It was August time, and I called UH first because it was Hawaii. I was like, okay, well, Hawaii would be nice,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure. And they said, yeah, okay, send me all these documents and this and that, and I'll call you next week. And I did that, and then the following week, oh, okay, we're ready to have you come. And I said, okay, well, when do you need me? And it was Friday, and he's like, okay, well, it's Friday, and school starts Monday. So just in a sort of a snap of the fingers, I was sitting in my house and in Australia, and Monday morning, I was flying in 6 a.m. flight to Honolulu and being picked up by the coach and dropped to the dormitory, which was an interesting experience.
Yeah, which one?
It was a Nui Nui.
Oh,
right
wow.
Down near. Yeah, and that was
cool. Palatial, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's actually got better. It was when I was there. It was pretty.
Wow.
It was pretty. You know the. And it was funny because my roommate apparently had thrown some guy off the second floor. He was a football player. He was close to getting kicked out. And so the HD for the dorm opened the door at 6 a.m. And he opens the door and there's beer cans all over the floor. And this huge football player slumped over the bed, half over the bed. And he's calling out his name. I won't say who it is. Calling out his name. He sort of looks up in a half-drunken daze and says, "Yeah, this is your new roommate." You know, and I was 19, and I was like, what the hell have I got myself
exactly.
into?
So what happened between Termina High School and UH?
I actually worked a couple of years. You know, I basically wanted to play tennis and make some money, so I... During that time, Australia was going through a sort of a recession, actually, so it was very difficult to get a job. But I needed a job, you know, to support mm-hmm. my tennis. We weren't millionaires, so I got a job with a resort in the town that I was living in.
To like the pro.
Yeah, well, no, actually as a gardener.
Oh.
You know, I was a junior, still qualified as a junior for my age, so... you know, in junior and amateur tennis, you can't make any money. You know,
right.
you lose your ranking
right.
in the world in Australia. So I needed a job, and so there wasn't jobs like tennis pro. There was jobs like gardener left. You know, and even with that, they hired me and another guy who was 16. I'd turned 17, and you know, they just put in someone between 16 and 18 to do this job as gardener. And we had like 150 people turn up, everyone, all sorts of people turned up, and they hired me and this other guy.
Wow.
And the way it was over there at the time, they worked so hard that the 16-year-old, the guy I worked with, actually got a hernia.
Jeez.
You know, but I would, you know, we would slog it out, you know, and that's what I did. So I was motivated to get a tennis scholarship and come to America.
So, I'm sorry, I didn't follow your career at UH. How good were you?
I was okay. I mean, the team, you know, it's a team sort of situation, so it's hard to judge because, you know, tennis is such an individual sport
yeah.
that you can win every single match you ever play. And
but were you the number one in singles, or were you?
I was always a number one or two.
Singles,
and so
uh-huh.
I had some good wins. I sort of resigned myself to trying to, you know, do personally as good as I could.
Yeah.
I beat the Rolex champion 1 year. national champion. I beat the NAIA Scholar National Athlete of the Year, who had been going to BYU at the time. I went three sets with Stanford's number one player. One of the years, Stanford is perennial number one in the nation, and this guy was pre-ranked number one in the nation as well. He was a left-hander. I was a left-hander. We're playing on Maui, and we played, and in college tennis you can have coaches out on the court, so I was sitting there and playing this guy, and he's number one player, pre-ranked in the nation. We had Dick Gould, who was the coach. He was a legend in tennis. He coached McEnroe when he was at Stanford before going on to becoming a pro. My coach is up in the crowd in the stands. I'm sort of sitting there going, okay. But it went well. I enjoyed it.
What was your major?
I was a business major and focused international business, and I had a minor in speech.
And what year did you grad?
I graduated in 96.
4 years then? So 89, 91?
Well, I went from 91 to 96.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and then a breakthrough job. And this can be, it could be at the museum, but it could be anything. It could be the gardening, where you just learn something about management, leadership, organizations, something, or work ethic. We're really hoping to learn a little bit more about your background. So while it could be something at the museum, just something that really had an effect on you and how you looked at working and those issues.
I'd actually say when I went to Mutual Publishing was my sort of breakout job. I didn't know that I was going to enjoy book publishing, but I found I was absolutely fascinated by it. It's a very creative job. You get to meet a whole bunch of people, run the gamut of different writers and artists and personality types with book publishing.
But go from production to
you meet book authors and they're sort of the colors of the rainbow. So some can be very conservative and stodgy, some are very flamboyant. It's just a really interesting medium to meet a variety of people. Also, we source globally, so that was interesting internationally as far as business. But I think probably the major aspect of it was, this was under Bennett Heimer, who was the owner, and he really sort of mentored me in a way in regards to the industry, but sort of got me into the mindset of thinking in terms of how to run a business, as opposed to being an employee of a business. And that really helped. It also, the industry accessed me an opportunity to meet with other people who were publishers within the industry. And soon enough, I was able to, learn from them as well. And so, it's always difficult to, make that leap from being someone who waits for orders and tries to do what is done, and then, going to taking the initiative and looking at it as a sense of ownership.
Right.
And that, I think I really got that there. And
What year was it you worked there? What years was it you worked there?
So it would probably be 2000 through 2003.
And what was your job?
I was basically sales and marketing, director of sales and marketing. But I resigned myself to learning everything. So.
And where actually is Mutual Publishing? Where's their offices?
They're here. They're in Kaimuki. They're on top of Wailea Avenue.
Oh.
On Center Street.
Okay, and a little known fact about you, and this is something that I always love it when I get emails about the last person we interviewed. He said, I've known this guy for years. I never knew that. The last guy was a Madonna fan, so you have to top that.
I don't know. I think I'm looking forward to U2 and Pearl Jam, but I think everyone knows that who knows me. I guess maybe I have a black belt in Kung Fu.
Oh, really?
I used to, after I got out of college and playing tennis, I was looking for something else to do. And so I went down to Chinatown and met an instructor, Sifu Seng Ao, and he runs a school down there, Ao's Shaolin Art Society. And so I got into that, and I...
You just started from scratch.
Started from scratch and worked my way up and ended up practicing and teaching down there under Tseng and the other instructors. And
you're a teacher?
Two styles, yeah. I was an instructor in Chinatown. And
I'm sorry, one more time, what's the name of the...
It's Al Shaolin Art Society. And so they practice two styles of Southern Shaolin style Kung Fu. And qigong and lion dancing. So I would practice kung fu and I'd do lion dancing, play ahead on the lion dance. Yeah, and Chinese New Year, we'd be down at the cultural center doing demonstration on the stage. So ironically, one of the two styles, Chu Li Fut, the qigong, the head person for the entire art for the world, lives in Sydney. So you're a Chinese guy who went through Hong Kong and now lives in Australia, emigrated to Australia, and you know, you got an Australian living in Hawaii learning kung fu and realizing the ultimate source of kung fu is actually in Sydney now.
Have you had a chance to study with him?
Yeah, well, I went down once and I did get to study with him and I and their instructors there. It's a great art. It's very practical. They all dominate the open full contact fighting throughout Australasia tournaments constantly, and make regular trips to China for practice sessions. Unfortunately, I've sort of had to taper it all off because
work,
and I've got kids too. So,
what's the attraction to Kung Fu?
You know, I love the physical and the mental discipline of of Kung Fu. It's one of those things. It's like tennis in a way. It's a challenge to yourself, and you will never be as good as you want to be, and you'll never be where you want it to be as far as your art. And you're always going to be challenged. There's always new things to learn and new ways to. You know, to approach even the same set and the same move. So
what spurred you to go down to Chinatown and look for
I wasn't exactly the person who stayed out of trouble when I was a younger person, so you know, I'd always, you know, thought, well, maybe I should formalize these skills. But you know, my friends,
you
and I
brawler growing up
a little bit, but I Yeah, a little bit. yeah, so actually, my friends and I, during school, had gone down to Chinatown because we're all interested. Yeah, while we're at UH and on tennis scholarship, we'd all gone down there, and we just we started Wing Chun and in the Cultural Plaza, and thought, oh, you know, this would be great, but we just couldn't do it.
Yeah, you know? I was going to say, what did the coach think about you guys?
Yeah, I don't think he minded, but, you know, we just, you know, I didn't have the money, and none of us really had the time, so we had to sort of, it dropped off, but I realized, hey, you know, I wanted to do it, and I'd actually gone down afterwards, years later, to the Cultural Plaza, and I'd gone into the area where I was pretty certain that's where the school was, and I walked in the door, and it was a Kung Fu school, but it wasn't the Wing Chun school, it was Al Shaolin Art Society. And I said, oh, I was, you know, I came down here because I thought this was the Wing Chun school. But he said, oh, yeah, well, this is, you know, this is us, and this is what we do. What do you know, would you be interested? And I found I was, and stayed, so.
Interesting. Okay. A mentor.
Definitely my father.
What's his name?
Dennis Collis. So,
Is he still with us?
Yep. Yeah, he's a couple of years ago. I went down to celebrate with him his 70th birthday. So he's I still have both my parents, but you know, he's sort of an inspiration to me.
Why?
Well, you know, an example would be, you know, his father passed away when he was 12 years old, and he was going to a prestigious boys' school in Sydney, captain of the football team, had a, you know, a great opportunity to go on to do incredible things, but you know, he recognized that there was a need for him to step up as being you know, a provider in the family, and so he literally quit school so that he could send his younger brother through school and and maintain, you know, economically for his mother, the place.
At the age of 12?
Yeah. Basically, he was doing a whole bunch of jobs. This is a long time ago. This is back in the 40s, so you could do jobs. There wasn't the kind of labor laws, certainly in Australia, so... He was sort of worked his way up from sort of paper boy and doing working in a general store. So he did two jobs and went from there. And you'd think with a situation like that, he would have said once to me or anyone else that I've ever been around that he kind of was regretting the fact that he didn't get his opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. But he never has ever once said to me that he ever regrets it, and that's the kind of humility and
so he never went to university.
Never went to university. But that's what's always inspired me. His work ethic and his compassion and his humility. I think that if I can be half the person he was, I'll be pretty much
that's
there.
That's nice. So what happened to the brother, the younger brother?
And this is the thing. He went on to be, he went into the police after he graduated and ended up being deputy police commissioner of the entire state. So he really did benefit from the fact that his older brother had been looking out for him.
Hmm. That's a nice thing to say about your father. Major challenge could be in your job, obviously, or it could be in your personal...
Well, I got a couple of challenges, as far as the museum, we've done some sorting out of our operations, and I think we're in a good place now. We're making great strides as an institution. We opened the Science Adventure Center. We've closed Wine Hall for its best and most comprehensive renovation in its history. We're building a visitor center on our Big Island property. We're doing things with HMC in the next year, which is Hawaii Maritime Center, which is our property as well. My challenge I'm tapped with primarily is creating a sense of identity for all these properties together. So a unifying sense of identity. Museums and nonprofit organizations typically have an identity as a result of circumstance. You do things or you say things or you have things and people think of you that way. We have a problem because we do so many different things. We do everything from cultural collections care to education programs and outreach. We do natural science research throughout the Pacific. We have a maritime center. We do dinosaurs. We have a traveling exhibit area where the last exhibit was Grossology, and then the next exhibit will be Centenario, which is a celebration of the Filipino centennial, and then after that is dinosaurs. So we have so many different messages.
Right.
How does it all coalesce into one message? And so the museum sort of asked me to work with the group that I have to develop that a more cohesive understanding about the museum, and obviously the value of that is letting people better engage with the museum and understand it and therefore appreciate it, make people feel like this is our museum, not the museum, and be a good representative of this state. And
The third property is on the Big Island?
Yeah, it's about a 14-acre property. It's an ethnobotanical garden called, its name's Amy Greenwald Ethnobotanical Garden. It's about 12 miles south of Kona and Captain Cook.
Huh.
And it was given to us about 20 years ago as a bequeathed to us from Amy Greenwald, who was a very noted family on that side of the island, Greenwald family. Who loved the museum and loved ethnobotany. And so it's one of the largest collections of native and indigenous plants, to Hawaii and Polynesia in Hawaii. But it's never had the kind of funding necessary to develop it into a defined experience. But it's a great resource for the community over there. We develop, we grow plants and we educate people, but we've been very lucky recently and worked hard to do a lot of this stuff, and we've got $1 million from the state appropriated and $500,000 from the county of Honolulu, of Hawaii, to to basically build a visitor center on that and start defining it as an experience.
When do you hope to do that? Have that?
We're going to break ground hopefully in the spring of next year, and hopefully in the spring of 2008.
So right now it's just kind of a wild garden?
Yeah, it has a basic structure to it. There is signage and a pathway in some areas, and it's set up like the coastal system. There's tropical plants, and then there's desert plants and coastal plants. Mm-hmm. So you've got your sections, and it's divided up in a logical sense, and you can get an experience out of it. But we're going to take it to a whole new level now.
And so when you said the major challenge is creating a sense of identity,
mm-hmm.
and we in the newspaper have talked about the Bishop Museum and this issue for a long time,
mm-hmm.
Spiders and dinosaurs and
mm-hmm.
all those things in the face of funding shortages in the past, what would you like that identity to be? Is it just the umbrella of this is our museum?
That's really the question that we're asking, and we've contracted a branding company mm-hmm. to work with us on that. We've selected an architectural firm to develop a master plan for this campus. We've organizationally for the first time put all of the public operations under one roof, so you've got everything from the very obvious retail products and shop and Bishop Museum Press to actually the exhibits department and the education department. So the total experience of what the museum is under one roof. So we've done that. The answer to the question is something we're going to work through. But I kind of look at it as being a gathering place, the museum itself. I don't know how else to define it at this point until we have smarter and more creative people mm-hmm. come through it and look at this idea with us. But we're a gathering place of new and old, of education and science and culture, of research, but also public. It's sort of a nexus point for a lot of things, and we just want to. I think our goals here is for people to recognize that, but also recognize how what it means to people who live here. That this is their museum. This is the museum that if they want to know more about where they live, not just culturally, but also the environment. The Science Adventure Center is the first themed science center in the nation, and it's on science of Hawaii. So you're not just talking about physics and chemistry. You're talking about volcanology, and you can actually see a volcano erupt, a representation. But
I would imagine you folks have a pretty high, there's a term they use in the branding, when I can't remember the term, I'm sure you'll know, but when you say the term Bishop Museum to somebody,
mm-hmm.
I imagine it ranks pretty high. People have a good feeling about it, whatever that is, whether it's from the science or the entertainment or the cultural aspect.
I think you'd find with any organization, any company, I think you'd probably find that stakeholder perception, you're probably looking for as a term, and it's negative or positive, but I think with us and many other organizations, that people have a distinct impression.
Right.
It's not necessarily negative or positive, but in our case, depending on your constituency or community and what your interaction with the museum, we have certain groups of people and individuals who remember what we've done in the past and really, look at us as that's what it was, and still negatively. There's a great amount of indifference. People know the museum's there, but really, the interesting or typical phrase is, what do you know about the museum? Oh, I was there in fourth grade. Right. I remember seeing the whale. So there's all this, it's almost indifferent when you say something like that, because it's a perception per se, but it's not really, it's just a memory, it's not really what we do or who we are, So we're trying to develop that specific perception and it obviously to be positive.
Okay. Hobbies of yours?
At this point, I try to swim and run, and for the most part, I look after my kids. I have fun with them. I have three boys. They're 12, 5, and 3.
What is their ethnic background?
They're Chinese, Hawaiian, Caucasian, and they're all in three different schools, so it's a military operation to drop them to school.
Oh my goodness! Where do they go?
The oldest goes to Mid-Pack, the middle one goes to Kahal Elementary, and the youngest just got into Kamehameha School's preschool in Keanu campus, which is over in Kahala, right next to Waldorf there. So it's actually a little bit better. It was worse before because I had my middle son Matthew was at Calvary by the Sea in Ina Haina, so I'd have to drive all the way out there and then come back in. So
and where do you live?
Makiki, actually.
So you had to go back and then come.
Yeah, right come. Down. Yeah.
Okay. Recent books you've read. They can't all be from the press.
Yeah, you probably get that a lot with people trying to promote their own stuff. honestly, I read the same number book to my youngest kid every day because he won't leave me alone about it. So it's just a 1 through 10, and he just loves it, you know. And so I read that to him, you know, probably almost every day, you know. And so that's just a counting book, but that's I'm glad because no matter how annoyed I am at the idea after a long day to read it one more time, I value the fact that he's interested in learning. And
when my kids were younger, they had the same thing. They would want to read a certain book, and you know, I could tell they're getting asleep, so I'd skip a page and then you missed me on the flopsy bunny.
For myself, I don't get to read a hell of a lot now because I'm typically reading emails or sometimes I read manuscripts from the press, but I just started Fiasco, the military, the American Military Adventure in Iraq by Thomas Ricks.
Is he the New York Times guy? Okay. So let's go back. We started talking about your career here at the museum. Mm-hmm. You when you came back to re-energize the press, and that was 3 years?
Yeah, about 3 years ago.
You were, your title there?
I was press director. Director of the press, the Bishop Museum Press here. And
so they loved you. You took over and dormant thing and made it a moneymaker.
24 months, we went from dead last as a publisher to the fifth largest in the state.
Dead last out of how many?
There's about 20 publishers who are real publishers in this state. Uh-huh. Then you get into one or two book guys. And then... so you know we're
able
to.
That's measured in
I would
copies.
Say, yeah, no releases. I would say, and it probably equates to revenue generation as well. We did things. We got some books out. We got some books that had been languishing for a while. We did a book called A Tropical Garden Floor, and this is a book that had been a replacement of a book called In Gardens of Hawaii, and it was started in 1984 and at the museum, and it literally had been 20 years, you know, that this thing had been languishing around trying to get published and all sorts of difficulties, and so it got handed over to me, and within 11 months we were able to get that thing published, and people were just sort of dumbfounded by the idea that, hey, we've got a press that's operating and executing and generating revenue and getting a lot of good, word out about the museum. And so I guess there was some reaction to that here.
And then when did you become, is it VP of Sales and Marketing?
They sort of gave me a placeholder title. It was Senior Director of Sales and Marketing for the museum.
What do you mean placeholder?
It seemed like it in hindsight because it only lasted like 3 months. And then I was promoted to VP. And I think board approval on anyone who's promoted or hired into a vice president position. So... I was senior director of sales and marketing for a while, but basically
when was that?
That would have been end of June last year.
June of 2005.
Yeah, June of 2005. I can remember because I'd taken a vacation for a week and I'd gone sailing with a friend of mine and his brother up in the San Juans in Seattle, up towards the San Juan Islands there, and I'd had a great time. It was about 5 days, and I'd come back, and I got a call from the CFO, and he said, did you have a good vacation? You're well rested? Guess what? So that was it. And from that promotion, I was I retained the press, but I had to find someone to replace my day to day myself. And then, but I was also given retail shops, our visitor industry sales, and PR marketing for the museum.
As director of sales and marketing.
Yep. Okay. And visitor services, which is all our admissions and events, and facility rentals, and then the sales and marketing aspects of the two subsidiary properties or the sister properties, HMC mm-hmm. and Amy Greenwell Garden, and so we've got into that, you know, and but it was a lot of fun, and we started to see some results and move things forward, and. I guess we weren't done yet, so as of July of this year, I formalized another promotion that was to public operations, and I think the...
And what does that... Tell me what that job means.
Well, you know, it changes the nature of it, you know, and...
Is that a new title?
Yeah, it's a new title, a newly created title, because we'd never done it before.
Right.
We wanted to sort of express... You know, a little bit, it's not per se sales and marketing. I kept all the stuff that was involved, but we're affecting change on a different level now, because what we really added into this mix was our education department and our exhibits department. So it's no longer a matter of talking about what we want to be and where we want to go and what we want to do and what we're doing now. It's actually being able to affect that. So when you talk about exhibit selections over the next 3 years, and you talk about educational programs and outreach to achieve, you know, your goals of helping people and educating people. It's all under one roof now, and so those things, aspects really change the nature of it, because it's no longer just promotion.
Well, and the title too.
Yeah.
Putting public in the title is...
Public operations, because we're really sort of split, you know, as an organization would be, between back house stuff
right.
and stuff that the public doesn't see, and then front house things. And the back house is the, you know, the obvious things like accounting and buildings and grounds and housekeeping.
Under?
No, they're under other people.
Okay.
Natural sciences also... is not in my area, because it's considered in a way back house, but also we've got a great natural science VP in that position. But they, you know, it's a research area.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of field work, and they.
But the exhibits, which is your mm-hmm. responsibility,
mm-hmm.
kind of overlaps with research and natural
science. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But your title is public. You need getting
yep.
some of those things out before.
Yeah. No, we've got to work as a team, you know,
yeah.
and that's you know, the bottom line at the museum, and we're doing it better than we've ever done it before. We've tripled our endowment. We're opening up new funding sources. We're understanding our public operations better and how it affects the entire museum and
yeah.
vice versa.
Well, that had been one of the issues in the previous, was everything was its own little fiefdom.
Yeah, you know, people want access, you know. I want to see the back house stuff in the
right.
natural science area, in the cultural collections area, and we're being able to work as a team. There's a real great click with the senior management group we have now. We like each other. We genuinely enjoy
well,
each
helps.
Other's company, and we're really on the same page as far as where we want to go. And we're, over the next few years, people are going to see a lot of dramatic results.
Please, what can the public expect to see in the coming months?
In the coming years, you know,
that might be different.
Well, we're looking at everything, you know. We're looking at our exhibit selections, you know, and recognizing who comes and what they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So our exhibit selections will continue to be on the traveling exhibit side, exciting and interesting, and something you wouldn't get to see anywhere else in Hawaii. On our in-house exhibits, a good example is the exhibit we just opened last week. On Labor Day weekend, which is a featherwork exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first real demonstration of the depth of our collections as opposed to the breadth. We typically have done things where you see a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. A couple of koa bowls, and, you know, and this one is the largest featherwork exhibition in history. Mm. And
so, it's all stuff that was here.
Yeah, all stuff here. We're the largest institution of, you know, that holds Hawaiian featherwork in the world. We have the most pieces, and so we wanted to let people in and be able to see these things, incredible pieces. And so we're going to be looking at the, you know, changing the mix, giving people new opportunities to see things that they don't get to see. So in essence, increasing our access will also open up behind the scenes tours,
really?
You know, to both sides there. Absolutely. Both sides being natural science side, because a lot of people are interested in our natural science collections.
Yeah.
We're the fourth largest natural history museum in the United States and the largest in the Pacific in terms of our collections. Our collections size is larger than the Field Museum in Chicago. And if you've seen the Field Museum, it's a city block, and we're a little place.
Yeah. So how would you have to do that? You'd have to set up an exhibit, right? Because it's all in storage right now.
Well, you start with what you can work with, and the short-term goal is to work within the area that we've got. And basically make it accessible to people. So you come into our collections area, and we pull drawers and show people things and talk about it. You know, the lofty long-term goals are, you know, that happen through branding, and our architectural master plan is where are we going with, you know, the institution in terms of needs of buildings. And
yeah.
I think Hawaiian Hall we're going to complete, and then we're going to take a serious look at Bishop Hall, which is the other historic structure on this campus that we'd love to bring back.
Hawaiian Hall, the renovation began when and the last
one? It closed July 10th, and we're getting in there in earnest. It's an incredible project.
Yeah.
It's going to completely revolutionize that structure, because we're dealing with not just the basics like air conditioning and an elevator so you can have access to the floors, but we're going to reinstall exciting things like the picture gallery. We have an art gallery that was originally in the building, and it got taken out because of environmental problems. Mm-hmm. But with these new environmental conditions, we can reinstall it. The museum has over 4,000 pieces of art, including 12 original Weber images. Hmm. that aren't out and don't ever go out on display, but we're going to be able to show them again.
When and how long will that renovation take?
The building structure itself will be completed around May of next year, so May of 07. We're looking to open the picture gallery and the Hawaiian courtyard area, which is going to be a three-story glass atrium where the elevator court is held. And that'll be a sort of a nice open space for, you know, various specific exhibits and events. That'll probably open in the late 2007, early 2008. And then hopefully around this time of next year, of 2008, we'll open the entire structure. The Hawaiian Hall, as people know it, that three-story area where the whale is
right.
located. And we've had an incredible concept put together for it. We went to the very best in the world to work with us on it. Guy's name is Ralph Applebaum. He's out of New York. He brings the expertise on building exhibits and building concepts for exhibits. Obviously, this is us and this is Hawaii, so we're pairing that kind of expertise. He did the Holocaust Museum. He did Clinton's Library. He's done the American Natural History Museum, various projects around the world. We coupled his expertise with the museum's staff, board members, and then Hawaiian stakeholders and community leaders in Hawaii for them to come up with a concept and for him to translate that into the how you would, you know, demonstrate that through exhibits. So it's going to be a complete renew of how we display our Hawaiian culture.
So he's involved in the design of the new Hawaiian Hall?
He's basically involved in the design of the interior exhibit,
right?
You know, and so how do you display the themes, you know? And so
process is still underway.
It's ongoing and will be for, you know, for at least another year. As you can expect, a huge thing to fill a three-story building full of stuff and make it coherent and tell the stories in ways that you want to do it. And so at the end of it, we're going to have over double the amount of stuff we have in there, so it's going to provide an access. Wow. That's his expertise, able to work the space really well. And but the concept of what we're trying to do is uniquely Hawaii, uniquely out of the group that we've got together, and it puts to the front Hawaiian culture. You know, the first where it, how it is before was Hawaiian culture on the first floor, and then immigrant cultures on the second and third floors, but where it's only going to have Hawaiian culture throughout the building at the end of it. And immigrant culture will find a place in another building.
And how many pieces would that be? You said it would be double.
You know, it's hard to say. There's a couple of thousand pieces in there, so maybe, you know, over 4,000 as a number. But, you know, when it comes down to it, does this fit or not? Can we put extra things because this looks a little bare or not? And, you know, it's almost hard to put an exact number on it. Yeah, but it's very exciting.
But we're still going to have spiders and dinosaurs and the things
absolutely
that bring the kids and the families, right?
Yeah, and that comes back to the gathering place theme. You know, we want to have a home for a little bit of everything here because we recognize that we have families who come in and just love it. I mean, we did Grossology and, people, we had, you know, we literally did 45,000 people in the month of July alone come through because it's just, people love to...
45,000 people.
Yeah. We do about 400,000 a year now, and memberships have grown. We've actually just hit 10,000 memberships. So that's almost 40,000 people as members, and that's doubled over a year. And so that's a good indication that people are reacting to the kind of exhibit selections we're making, but more importantly, conveying that to them what's going on, because there's just so much going on in Hawaii. You got to make sure you.
And how much overlap is there from somebody that goes to Grossology and might go to the Hawaiian Hall when it opens, or I mean, are they different groups?
They're not mutually exclusive, you know, because I think there's going to be a percentage of adults who have kids like myself who kids will just drive them crazy. It's like the McDonald's thing. We've heard stories of people driving past and saying, that's where the Grossology, I want to go back, you know. But then, you know, I'm interested in Hawaiian culture, and many, families are, parents are. So there is that crossover. So we're seeing people who come for various reasons multiple times, and that's the value of a membership.
But the exhibit is the traveling exhibits are still the ones that pull people in, the big numbers, right?
They pull in. We have spikes in resident admission. We have a pretty steady visitor admission, and we do have a steady baseline resident Carmina membership and visitation, because we have events going on like Moonlight Melee and other things. But yeah, when something's new in town, you know how it is. People say, hey, and there's not a lot to do with families, as people know, and so I bring my kids. It's safe. God forbid, they may learn something, but they're gonna have a lot of fun too.
Slip that in.
Yeah.
So tell me what the have there been constant themes between your job at the press, the Bishop Museum Press, the short stint in sales and marketing, and director of operations that have, you've obviously been successful at all of them. Are there common approaches you bring to the job, themes that you say, this is...
Yeah, well, I think, what I try to... always bring, and I think I brought to Mutual Publishing because we doubled our sales in the first year I was there too, is performance. It's easy to sit back and cruise, I was inspired by publishing, and the museum is a whole different level of inspiration. The museum deserves the opportunity for it to be successful, be appreciated and loved and respected. I think it's suffered under the fact that it's economically, it's not always got the right people for the job, people who are not motivated or inspired by being here, or maybe just overcome by the amount of problems that an institution of this size can throw at someone. But what I always try to do is make sure that that talk is cheap. You want to prove results, that results orientation is what I want and expect of myself and want and expect of the people who work with me, because that's where you say to people, this is the reason why you want to support us, because because we're doing things. We're not just talking about being the State Museum for Hawaiian Culture. We're actively working towards making it better, making it more accessible, making it easier for people to learn more about.
But yeah, it was one of the things that, as you've told the history of your career here in Hawaii, it looks like what I'm picking up is you look at things that have not been appreciated or developed or have been underutilized, and they're sitting right here.
Yeah.
It's a dormant title,
or put it on tape. I've been extremely lucky because of, by chance or luck or karma or maybe a little bit of help on my thought process, but I've found opportunities. I guess the common theme has been, and if I was to go back further beyond where I came from the museum, I had a medical company job before that. I've always found sort of the diamond in the rough, as far as job opportunities. And maybe that's my business personality. I'm a builder, and so I love the challenge of looking at something and saying, this needs a lot of work, and what would it take to turn it around? Mm-hmm. I don't mind running from the front, but at the same time, it's real exciting to be able to come in here because, there's just so much potential for the museum as an organization in so many ways. We do so many things that most people don't have any idea about, we have so many things that people don't know that, being in charge or being responsible for letting people know that is exciting because at the end of the day, if someone turns around and says, I didn't know the museum had a million photographs in their archives and the oldest photograph in existence, taken in Hawaii, and the largest collections of everything, and discovered 200 new species in the last 5 years alone. I mean, it's kind of funny because you read these, sometimes articles about, someone finding a species of something. And our guys, who have sort of flown under the radar, like, yeah, I found like three things in the last month alone. Well, that's not very interesting,
Really?
So, yeah. And so, but we've never really organized ourselves and understood ourselves really well. And so that's, I think that my common area or theme is sort of being lucky enough to sit come into an area where I can see the potential, and I just get excited, and I work, as hard as I can to turn
it
around.
There's two issues about that I want to ask you, and then I'll wrap up because I know it's taking a lot of your time. One is that the museum has a lot of people that have been here for a long time, and they've been, this is a management question,
mm-hmm.
they've been here for a long time, they've been through regimes, they've been through turmoil, controversy, what have you, and, I'm assuming don't always felt like they've been appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And here comes some guy from the outside with a lot of enthusiasm, young. How do you get people like that to buy in?
Well,
this is a problem that's in any organization, right?
I think what I try to do, and I've always tried to do, is get people to know me, and that's everyone. I'm not about being high maka-maka in any sense of the word, and I have pretty humble background actually as far as my economic origins, and I worked everything from cherry picking to packing lettuce when I was in high school, and so I think what I want to I try to convey to people is that I understand to a certain extent, every level of the organization in terms of, I've worked in jobs that are,
mm-hmm.
like that too. And so I think what I'm really just trying to, let people know that I'm accessible and I try to be a friend. I mean, Australian attitude is typically informal, and so...
I mean, you share your background with...
Yeah, and I tell people, I try to, people know, about me and what I'm like, and for better or worse, and I really, I try to be friends with everyone, and I want to be, and I think people sort of pick up on that. It's not an easy thing. I mean, I kind of liken it, I say this to people, change is like, it's kind of like moving a house. You can envision yourself in this new place that you've just bought or rented, and it's exciting and interesting, and But when it comes down to it, it's stressful, you know, because you got to, you know, get the utilities turned off and mail redirected, and you've got to move all your stuff. So although people can even see the benefits of a change, the actual process is very stressful. And so, you know, it would, you know, all of us try to get better at talking as an institution. We haven't traditionally communicated what we wanted to do and why and how. You know, I've been wanting to, and we're actually unveiling it at our next all staff meeting. A museum wide incentive program, you know, and I said to the rest of the senior management, hey, you know, we've got to get going on this. It's basically a suggestion system where we're literally going to give people money or other, you know, or a choice of money or cash or benefits for, you know, good suggestions that support the museum. And it's just the first thing.
Suggestion.
Yeah, it's just a good it's one thing, you know, it's one program, but we're going to continue. The next one will be, you know, I can't talk about yet, but we're just going to keep rolling them out. And so what I've tried to also, you know, instill is that, you know, my job here is not to be the boss. My job here is to be your advocate at the senior management table. Mm. You know, I'm here to hear what you have to say and tell people up there, you know, we need to do this. You know, what is the opportunity cost if we don't? And that's where the museum has changed fundamentally. We don't look at just the cost anymore, and that's what it was always about.
Right.
It was always about, you know, well, you know, I don't want to be always about, but it seemed like the, you know, senior management was about holding the line about what we wanted to do. But, you know, there was a wall between senior management and staff, and now we're more about, well, what do we need to do as an institution to work together? What is the opportunity cost if we don't hire an extra person, if we don't do this exhibit?
Right.
And we're getting a lot more down the road towards that, and it's exciting because people are reacting, and so I developing incentive programs and you know, just being a general advocate for my staff.
Now, how often do you have all staff meetings?
Once a month.
And how many people is that?
We have about 190 full-timers and another
campus-wide.
Yeah, museum-wide, plus another 50 part-time and casual people. But we don't, you know, not everyone can turn up.
No. But I mean, everybody's invited.
Yeah, everyone's invited.
Where do you have those meetings?
They're over in Atherton, Halau. You know, the other thing, just little things. You know, I changed the menu. We used to offer just sort of basic pastries and coffee and water, and so I said we need bacon, you know. Bacon is one. That's the gold standard. So, you know, I told our visitor services manager, let's kick it up a notch. So we offer fruit and rice and you know, and bacon. It's a full breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, here's another reason to come. You know,
makes a big difference. I'm sure, thank you very much.
It doesn't seem like a hell of a lot, but this is moves for the museum because nonprofits don't usually just spend money without seeing literally a direct relationship to what it's going to be.
But did you sense that, though? I mean, you know, I could see you coming in all enthusiastic and everything, and people just going, oh, God, here we go again.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I, you know, it's under Bill Brown's administration, it's better than it's ever been. You know, I was under Duckworth at sort of the end of his tenure, and morale was extremely low. You know, and so I had a question to ask myself when I was offered the job. Do I want to go back to that? Is it what it was before?
Right.
And then I was real, you know, I felt like I took a chance a little bit. I decided I'd rather be captain of the ship instead of first mate of the largest publisher. And I was pleasantly surprised that people were, you know, it turned around, the motivation was there. But there was, you know, still lingering issues, but we're working our way through those.
Sure.
Recently, with organizational structure changes,
it's a very political place. I mean,
but it's more than ever. It is a one institution who is excited about its future. You know, now you could go walk out the door and probably find someone who say, you know, Collis, what's he talking about? You know, but you know, it takes time to get through the things. When day before the all staff meeting this month, you know, I mean, I got suggestions from one of the employees here. Just, you know, exciting new people coming in and saying, hey, you know, I want to help. I've got a suggestion. I said, well, hold on to it till the end of the month. I can't tell you why, but, you know, you want to say it later because, you know, there's going to be some benefit to it. So, you know, but until that you know, those things get rolled out, people are going to have, you know, their idea about where it is. But
right.
we're much better off than we were before, and we're moving in the right direction.
Okay, last question. What are the challenges as an Australian being in charge of operations of, you know, Hawaiian culture, history, and Pacific issues? Is it...
It's not as challenging as you would think, you know, because I'm sort of the Howley, you know, who's, you know, hasn't been.
I really mean politically. I mean, are there some sensitivity issues you're always aware of, or have to?
You know, I think when people get to know me, then they're fine, you know. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, through publishing, meet a lot of people, community leaders in a variety of areas, including Hawaiian culture and people who know me. You know, so can pick up on what I, you know, what I'm like as a person. I, you know, in my spare time, I started a book festival, you know, because I really care about education in this state, and I really wanted to change literacy as well. And so, you know, I think politically, there's been no problems whatsoever. Actually, I've never come across a situation where someone has said, well, why is he there because he's Australian? Or why is he approaching me because he's Australian? Or
well, what do you know about this?
Yeah, what do you know about this? You know, I try to be a student of it as right. well. You know, and then the other good thing about book publishing is you read manuscripts about 8 times before they end up being published. So we've done stories on, you know, Lua and famous people in history here and cultural traditions and folk tales of Hawaii. So My knowledge has grown. I'll never be, you know, I won't be a Hawaiian scholar per se, but you know, I think some people are surprised sometimes, you know, that I would know. You know, what? How did you know that? You know,
what was the book festival you created?
It's called Hawaii Book and Music Festival. The first one was this year in April.
Where was that?
It was at Honolulu Hale grounds. Mayor Mufi Hanneman was our honorary chair.
When you said you created it, is that part of the museum?
No, on my spare time. Not that I have any, but I was president of the Book Publishers Association for some years, and they had always wanted to do something. You know, every major city in the United States has a book festival, every one of them, except Honolulu. And so they've been kicked around many times over the last 20 years, and I just said, I want to do it. Let's do it.
Is that going to be an annual thing?
It's going to be an annual thing. It'll be next year, May 1920, at the same grounds.
Now, is that through the Book Publishers Association?
Actually, we, you know, through this, you know, process of developing, I realized that it needed to be its own separate 501c nonprofit organization, so we established that.
Called what?
The Hawaii Book and Music Festival, so it does business as that, and it was a great event. You know, it was timed. There was a lot of stuff going on that weekend, but we still had 10,000 people turn up first year. We had over 200 authors there. We had various pavilions running on different themes. So we had a children's stage, and we had a music stage. We had a Hawaiian culture and language stage. We had a cooking stage. We had a storytelling, so we had poetry slam. Just ran the gamut. And these book festivals throughout the United States, extremely popular because it brings together people to not only meet the actual person who wrote that book that they really love, but it was a chance to talk story and about issues, because these guys are, you know, often experts in what they wrote about. So you get a lot of interesting, you know, discussions going on.
I didn't realize you were behind that.
Yeah.
What is a 501c9?
C9.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, 501c3 is what we are. They're a non-profit. A 501c9, I believe, is a non-profit supporting organization. It is... and I'm not an IRS lawyer, but I think it's basically an organization that enjoys the benefits of nonprofit, but doesn't have the, you know, the rigorous amounts of regulations on 501c3s. The book festival is a 501c3 though.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think you said 501c9.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, where did the proceeds go for that?
Were
there any proceeds?
There were proceeds, you know, and that's the funny thing. We, you know, probably one of the best things about this festival was despite, you know, it being a first year and so many things going on in Hawaii all the time, most festivals don't make a dime, you know. And we talked to John Howell at Easter Seals about the Taste of Honolulu, and they really, you know, had a tough time
the
first couple of years.
Recently they've had to start charging, and that was controversial.
But they're making a lot of money now towards their cause. But we were able to not only break even the first year, but we were able to make money, and we just last week did the check cutting ceremony to the two beneficiaries of our festival, and that's Read to Me International, which is an advocacy for reading for children to support literacy, and Hawaii Literacy, which is one of the leading organizations focused on a variety of literacy programs, mainly towards adult literacy, where there's literally one in four adults in Hawaii are functionally illiterate. So, which basically means can't read past the fifth grade level of reading. So we were able to make money, put a little bit aside towards making next year's festival bigger and better, hire an executive director to that means, and give money to the beneficiaries first time around. So all in all, it was real successful. Wow. All of our sponsors are coming back. Maybe the advertiser as well. They were part of it.
So we had our Juan Adams book out there.
Yeah.
So how much were the checks that you cut?
Not a lot. I mean, it was basically $5,000, you know, but,
better to make a profit.
We decided to do, you know, something is better than nothing, you know, and so they were real pleased with that because it can grow.
Okay. Blair, anything else we need to touch on? We covered a lot of ground here.
I think we covered a lot. You know, I guess I wanted to convey that we're real excited about where we're going. We seem to be on a, we have the hot hand right now with the museum. We're working together well, and we're only improving upon that, and I think people are going to be excited, you know, in the coming years to see how we change, because I think it'll benefit a lot of the people in Hawaii directly, no matter who you are, whether you're a family person or a cultural expert or a natural scientist.
But you feel that momentum with the team and the,
and
the new buildings.
There's tangible benefits like our endowment growing and our and buildings being built and renovated and funds coming in, but that's translating internally to people starting to realize that we're addressing issues that have internally been around for a long time. Wages and incentives and programs to benefit and opportunities beyond those things for these people who work here, and we're excited about that too.
Okay. Thanks, Blair. I really appreciate all the time.
Thank you.